main speaker for this evening, Eric G. from San Diego.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Eric Graff. I want to thank Joe for essentially asking me to come here and save my own life tonight. And that's what AA is for me today. And, you know, I didn't realize that when I first got here. Had you have offered yourself as a patient at this hospital, I would not have taken you. If I had been able to avoid it, people like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person, I have profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution. And if you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new and you've been in that place of hopeless desperation, that place of I can't do it. And I am a perfect example of a guy who my entire life could not do it. I'm a guy my entire life who would come up against situations and I'd say, I can't do it. I tried to get sober for so many years and I would sit there and consistently tell myself, I'm going to do it today, and I couldn't do it. You know? I'm a guy who has been given more opportunities than most people on this planet, and I still couldn't do it. You know, I, for some reason inside my head, I could not muster the ability to do anything on my own. And it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and people started showing me simple things, simple actions that I take in my life on a daily basis that I've been able to do little things. See, this is a program of great change for me, and it's taken a long time to accomplish very little. You know? Yeah. You know, it's funny. I love how Megan talked about the exterior stuff, you know, how that doesn't buy happiness. And what's the first thing I see when newcomers come in here and get sober? You know, they want to come in here. The first agenda on their job is one of three things. A, get a job. B, get a car. And C, our favorite one, is get somebody to share all that with, you know. And that order changes, you know. Some of us have different priorities, you know. I knew what my priority was. It wasn't A or B. Anybody here doesn't have a sponsor? Is there anybody in here who's willing to sponsor? This is our 12th suggestion. Carrying this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. You hear a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous that aren't true. I was talking to somebody the other day who... I was talking to her and she said, well, you know, I haven't worked all 12 steps, so I can't sponsor anybody. And that's a lie. I was talking to somebody else who said, I don't have a year, I can't sponsor anybody. That's a lie. If you have 2 days sober and somebody new walks through that door, you can show that person where the bathroom is. You can show that person where the coffee is. You can help that person find a seat. See, what I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous is no matter what my character makeup is, as long as I'm standing at the door or sitting in the meeting or standing out front and I'm reaching my hand out, I'm being a good Alcoholics Anonymous member, period. You know? I'm sober today because a little plumber reached his hand out to me. He didn't know me from Adam. He just reached his hand out to me and said, welcome. And it's these simple actions that I've learned to take in here that allow me to screw my life up and stay sober at the same time. And if you're new and you stick around, I really hope you remember what I just said. Because everybody I've talked to that has any sort of sobriety has said the same thing. That they've made mistake after mistake after mistake. And they've showed up consistently and they've stayed sober. When I was young, and some of you might be able to relate to this, when I was young, I would get in trouble, and I would always say, you know what? I've done all these things good, and I'd name them off. You know, I got up, I brushed my teeth, I put on my clothes, I didn't argue, I got in the car, I went to school, I did my homework, you know, and then I punched a kid at school. And then I went home, and I did my chores, and I didn't watch TV, and I went out and played, and I got along with everybody, and my mom was pissed. What's the first thing that came out of her mouth? Eric, why are you hitting people? And I'd go, Mom, but I did all this stuff right today. And at almost 11 years sober today, I use that same thinking with my sponsor. I have a sponsor, his name's Charlie Hill, who lives in Las Vegas, Nevada. Wonderful man. And I was talking to him about that in a relationship I was in. I was like, you know, I did this, I've done this, I've treated her with respect, all this stuff, and I did this one thing wrong. And he goes, Eric, this is the reality of it, okay? He goes, we're going to do this. You're a math guy. I'm a carpenter, so I'm pretty good with numbers. He goes, good deeds are worth 1 point, okay? Bad deeds are worth 50. How's your day going? And he's absolutely right, you know. And what I do is I run my life on that one good deed all day, and then I think I can act and behave however the hell I want to. You know, I'm a product of really good sponsorship, but I haven't been a good sponsee. I'm a product of really good friendship, and I haven't been a good friend. I'm a product of really good work ethic, but I haven't always been a good worker. I'm overpaid in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've treated people in ways in Alcoholics Anonymous with a lot of time sober that warrants me not to be sober today. See, I'm the kind of guy that can make a mistake, a pretty big one. And as long as I show up to my home group and clean up chairs, I think that my behavior is acceptable. And for a lot of years, I thought this program was a behavior modification program, and it's not. As long as I take the actions in my life today that warrant me not to pick up a drink, I'm going to be okay. My perception of what I think okay is might not be okay. But I don't have a lot of control over that now, do I? You know, I come from a loving, caring, alcoholic family. You know, I have no reason. I have no reason to be alcoholic. And I want you guys to know something. I'm going to talk about my past before I started drinking, when I was drinking, and when I was sober. And none of that stuff before I started drinking make me alcoholic. I want to be real clear about that. I'm alcoholic for one reason, three parts. First reason is I have a mental obsession of the mind, which means that when I get the thought of a drink in my head, I cannot get it out. And I will go to any length. I will convince myself that I need to go to any length to get that first drink. Second, when I put that first drink in me, I physically can't stop. My body craves it. And the third reason, the third part of it, which I think is the most profound thing about alcoholism and keeps alcoholics out there drinking, is I mentally can't stop. I cannot convince myself to stop drinking. And that's the big question mark around here, you know? My whole life, people would ask me, Eric, why don't you straighten up? Why don't you just stop drinking? Why don't you act right? My whole life they've been telling me that. And I don't know. Mark told me that this morning on the phone. Travis told me that yesterday on the golf course. And, you know, I lived in just a fine little alcoholic family. You know, Mom was that mom that liked to, you know, like sew, and she was into cooking, and she had international dinner night, and we had, I remember the 4th of July parties, and Dad was an abusive drunk, and I remember he'd come home, he was an engineer at Boeing, he'd come home late at night, he worked the swing shift, so he'd be home at 2 in the morning, and And I'd run out there, and he'd be strumming his guitar, drinking a Budweiser, and I'd go sit on his lap, you know. And I didn't see anything wrong with that situation as a kid. You know, I just thought it was normal, you know. And what happened was that at a certain point in time, my dad became a violent drunk, started beating my mom. And at 5 years sober, my mom had to leave my dad because he was violent, you know, and she was worried for the kids. And something happened to me at five. I don't know what it was. I don't blame it on my parents getting divorced. I don't blame it on my mom taking my sister away, me and my sister and myself away from my dad. But something happened in my head, and I started thinking different. And what happened was is my behavior became erratic at five, man. I was uncontrollable at five. I was uncontrollable at six. I was uncontrollable at seven. And at 9 years old, my behavior was so erratic, my parents had to do something with me. And, you know, their parents, for the first time, there's no handbook on this crap, you know. And they had to put me in psych wards and boys' homes and foster homes as a little kid. And none of that makes me alcoholic. That's just the path I went down. And what I realized when I was in those places, and I don't know if you guys have heard Bill C. talk, but he's got a saying that he says, and he goes, it's something like this. He goes, I've got a bit of a problem with authority. And I had a bit of a problem at authority when I was five, you know. I didn't want to be told what to do. I didn't want any direction. I'm 36. I still have a bit of a problem with authority, you know. That's why I work for myself. My poor partner, if you could hear me talk. And what happened when I was in those places is I felt so different, you know, and you hear it all the time from up here, you know, I felt so different. I felt so alone. And you know, one of the biggest things that'll tear Alcoholics Anonymous apart is we make people feel different in here. You know, we judge people that walk through the door. We judge people for their character. We judge people because of the people they hang out with or where they work or what meetings they go to. And that feeling of being different is the same in every single one of us. That feeling of different doesn't segregate itself because of our ethnic background, where we work, how old we are, how much time sober we have, what meetings we go to. It doesn't care. You know, my biggest shortcoming is I feel different. And it's my job as an alcoholic and Alcoholics Anonymous to try my hardest to make everybody feel welcome and the same as they walk in that door. And I haven't done a good job of that in 11 years. I've done a good job at it sometimes, but a lot of the times I haven't. So, I'm feeling so different in these places. You know, I'm waking up in different foster homes every other week, and I don't feel loved, and I feel like everybody hates me. And, you know, I needed a drink at like 7, man. You know, a drink at 7, I would have been all right. You know, I would have been like, whatever, send me over to that one. You know, like, I don't care. And what happened at about 10 years old is I saw some boys doing some sexual stuff in these foster homes. And they were doing it to each other. And my first natural thought is I need to do that if these guys are going to like me. Because I wanted these guys to like me. I wanted to be loved. I wanted to be respected at a young age. And I was willing to do anything for it. And that behavior right there would follow me into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll do anything you guys want as long as you like me, as long as you accept me. I'll put on whatever face I need to put on. I'll say yes to whatever I need to say yes to. I'll say no to whatever I need to say no to as long as you guys accept me. that behavior has riddled me in sobriety to spots of at 7.5 years sober, I wanted to take my own life, sitting in these rooms, going to 7 meetings a week, doing tons of service work, and I wanted to take my own life sober because I just didn't feel like you guys accepted me. That behavior will eventually have led me to take my first drink. I don't believe I was alcoholic until I took that first drink. I think I was a normal person. I know that sounds kind of strange after me telling you about my past, but I think I was pretty damn normal, you know? And what happened is there were some boys, and they were... is that it? Cool.
Thanks.
And what happened is at 12 years old, I saw some kids drinking, and they said, "Do you want some?" And I didn't hear, "Do you want some alcohol?" What I heard was, "Is do you want us to be your friend?" And I said, "Yes, absolutely, I want you to be my friend." And I took that first sip of alcohol. It wasn't even that good. I love people who go into... And I didn't, like, spit it out and, you know, go into the hole, my turn green. And I love those stories, you know, the old-timers get up here and they really just dive into that first drink, you know. That wasn't my experience, you know. I had the drink. I'm like, this stuff's pretty bad. I'm not going to drink it again. And then the bottle came back around to me and I immediately had another sip. And, and... I didn't become jump behind the dumpster that night with a bottle of vodka wrapped around a paper bag and a Walkman and become a gutter drunk that night. You know, I just kept living my unmanageable life. And this whole time I'm running in and out of foster homes. You know, my dad lived down here in San Diego and we were up in Washington. And I kept telling my mom, you know, what a superman my dad was. And, you know, I hate you and I want to live with my dad because my dad was this Disneyland dad. You know, I'd come down here for 4 weeks out of the year and we'd go to Disneyland and SeaWorld and down to Mexico and go camping. And I had the super dad, you know. Of course he's super. We do all the fun stuff. And my mom told me, she's all, honey, that's not... I don't think that's the best for you. My mom never talked bad about my dad, even though he was a drunk. You know, I'd hear the phone calls. My dad would call my mom in a blackout just yelling at him. 4.5 years ago, I got the privilege of dropping my dad off at a rehab. And if I wasn't sober, guys, that would not have happened. If I wasn't sober, there would have been nothing I could have done for my dad. As much as I hated my dad 4 years ago, there was nothing that I could have done for that man if it wasn't for you guys. If you guys didn't shake my hand when I walked in the door. If you guys didn't let me sit in these meetings being that irritable, arrogant, ego-driven prick that I was in these meetings all that these years. I could not have done that for my dad because my dad is all those things that I just said. And because I was able to sit in here and you guys loved me for it, I was able to love my dad in that situation. And my dad's still sober today. I don't have a great relationship with him today. We don't talk about recovery. We hang out 3 times a year, and it's perfect. You know? I love it. And today I get to be a son to my father. You know? When he calls, I answer the phone. I make my dad proud today. You know? And that's not... When I got sober, guys, my dad had a restraining order against me. You know? That's the kind of drunk I am. So, my mom finally gave in. She threw in the towel, you know, and she said, "Okay, fine, you need to go live with your dad. You need to have that experience." And the first 30 days living with my father was, dude, if my life could stay in that first 30 days for the rest of my life, oh, it'd be perfect. you know? And what happened after that 30 days is, my dad started getting abusive. And I started drinking more, and I started using more. If you're old timers, I drugs are a part of my story, and I want to apologize for that. You know, if I would have known that I was speaking at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at 12, I would have said no to that joint. I'm going to be speaking here. You know, I can't. I got to stay true to the game. But that's not the case. Also, did some recreational speed use for about 10 years. That was fun. And anyway, eventually what would happen is I needed to put something in my system to deal with that man. Because I knew that when I went home at night, I was going to get my ass kicked. I knew it, you know. I knew it without a doubt. I knew it 4 days out of the week that when I got home after 9 o'clock, I was going to get my ass kicked. And I needed a buffer, man. I needed an ass-whooping buffer. And so I would drink and use, man. And I wouldn't care about everything that was going on at my house. You know? I would leave that house in the morning and my life instantly got better. And then I'd start drinking and using because I would remember that I'd have to go home. And then the minute I put that alcohol in my body, I was like, whatever. Oh, there's so much. So, I met this girl, my first love. And and eventually what would happen in that relationship, she's not alcoholic, I'm alcoholic. And I'm drinking to a blackout state pretty much, you know, 3 or 4 times a week. And she kept telling me the same things that I've heard my entire life. Eric, you need help. Eric, you need to straighten up. Eric, you need to stop drinking. And I would say, I know, but I can't. I wasn't telling her that, of course. I mean, I got to hold on to that lifeline. But I was telling her, I can't. I was telling myself in my head, this is what I wanted to tell her, but I couldn't. I can't. You know, I got to do this. This is how I live. I knew I was alcoholic long before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that normal people don't drink the way that I drink. I knew that normal people don't treat their girlfriends the way I treated my girlfriend. I knew that people don't treat their parents the way I treated my parents. Like I said, you know, 2 years before I got here, my parents got a restraining order against me, you know, because I'm a stand-up guy. I'm a good son. And that thinking is the reason I drank for a long time. Is because I would wake up in the morning and I would know what a piece of crap son I was, what a piece of crap boyfriend I was, what a piece of crap worker I was. And I would have to drink so I could get back to normal, which was, I'm a great boyfriend. I'm a great son. I'm a great worker. Because my natural state of mind isn't that. My natural state of mind is, you're a piece of crap, Eric. And eventually what would happen is that woman would leave me. And she left a year before I got sober. And what happened is when she left is I felt so alone. And I felt like nobody loved me, and I felt like I wasn't accepted, just like I did when I was a little kid. And I had nowhere to turn. I had burned up all my options. Nobody wanted to help me out anymore. Nobody wanted to see me anymore. And that last year of my life was dark, man. It was... I was drinking myself to sleep at night because I was physically addicted to alcohol. I had to have the drink so I could sleep. And I'd come to in the morning and I'd have to do drugs because I physically couldn't get out of bed. I was so drunk. And I'd have to do drugs so I could just kind of get my bearings so I could get moving again. I don't know how you guys wake up in the morning, but I'll explain to you how I wake up in the morning. Most of you guys probably wake up in your bed. My hat's off to you. I wake up in my car, somewhat parked in my driveway, with the radio on, the motor running, and a full beer between my legs, and I have no idea what happened last night or how I got into my driveway. And that was a 6 out of the 7 days a week. That's how I woke up in the morning. And that was normal living. I mean, I don't think I'm alone in here, but maybe I am. And what would happen is some of my prior thinking to getting sober. I'm framing these big houses in Rancho Santa Fe and Fairbanks and I'm shooting these straps, these metal straps, onto the bottom of these beams above my head, and there's a block wall in front of me. And most people, you know, they take what you call a palm nailer, or they use a hammer, you know. Not Eric. Eric takes a nail gun, which is pneumatic, means powered by air, and he shoots the nails through the strap, and these little holes that the nail can barely fit through, okay? I've got sunglasses on. I have my safety, my PPE going. Okay? And I'm plugging along, and I freaking, one of the nails misses the hole, and it bounces off the strap. It hits the block wall, and it hits me right in the, you know what. Okay? And it hurt, man. I'm like, oh. I'm pretty drunk, so I'm like, whatever. And I keep going at it, you know. Normal people would probably go, this isn't a smart idea. My thinking when I'm under the influence of alcohol is, keep going. That was just a mistake. So I'm going along, plink, 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 poof. Nail misses the hole, hits the metal strap, hits the block wall, hits me in the same spot twice. The wheels are turning now, folks. Okay, this is where great ingenuity comes into play as an alcoholic. You got to be smart if you're going to survive out there, okay? And if you're going to be an alcoholic, you can't let looking bad bother you, okay? So I'm thinking, I'm like, what do I do? I'm like, you know what? I need a shield. Perfect idea. So I go and I get a 5-gallon bucket lid from, you know, like they have at Home Depot. They're orange. Everybody's seen one. They go in a 5-gallon bucket. And I hike it up under my tool belt as a shield. I mean, at that point, that thing was the only thing I had going for me, you know? This is my best thinking as an active alcoholic. I got to test the shield out. Yeah, I got to make sure it works before I keep going. I got, you know, 4 hours worth of straps to nail. So I hike that bucket lid underneath there. I take my nail gun. I pull the safety back on it, hold it about 3 feet out, and pull the trigger. Plastic's not that thick. I started bleeding a lot. I'm a good shot. And I'm sitting there holding myself with a cup of blood in my hand, and my boss comes over to me and he goes, Eric, what were you thinking? It was totally justified in my head. I had to test it out, Ray. Now I know how moms feel with their kids. They're like, really? So I've got a 1978 Volvo station wagon because I'm rolling in my addiction, just like the rap song. And I'm building these track homes, And in between these track homes, these miniature roads have been made because of the tractor that comes through with the lumber to drop the lumber off at each one of these track homes. And my first thought is, I'm thinking rally car. You know, like, they got cool little berms. And so I get in my little Volvo, and I want to be a show-off, you know, because I want everybody on the job to think I'm, like, something special. And I start rallying around all these houses. The houses are pretty big, and the tractors aren't as big as the houses. So these roads, like, cut right next to the house, and then another road comes from the around the corner of the house. And I'm going full speed, tractor pulls out, bam! My boss comes up to me. He goes, "Eric, what were you thinking?" "Ray, don't you see it? Don't you see what I'm seeing here? This is a rally track." He goes, "Eric, I'm going to give you two choices. You can go take a UA test, or you can just quit on your own recognizance." I'm going to take a UA test. I'm going to show him. I go, "I'll be back tomorrow." He goes, "No, you'll go take the UA test and you'll sit at home until we get the results, and then you can come back to work." So I never went back to work there because I didn't pass the test. So what happened right before I got sober is I'm living in Oceanside, and my buddy Vern just got out of prison, and he goes, "Eric, I need a place to stay. I have 6 months sober." No, he goes, "I have 6 months clean in Narcotics Anonymous, and you know, I'm going to meetings, and I need a place to stay. I need to get back on my feet." And I said, "Yeah, I don't really sleep a lot, so go ahead. You can just stay at my place." And you know, a few days goes by, and I walk in the house one day, and he's got this book. It's this little blue book. I go, "What the hell is that?" He goes, it's the NA basic text." "What?" He goes, "Yeah, man. You know, I've been clean for 6 months, and I'm going to meetings, and I got a sponsor, and I, you know, I'm really doing this deal." He's all, "You want to go?" I'm like, "What? Go to what?" He goes, "To an NA meeting." I'm not an NA meeting guy. I'm not an AA meeting guy. But I go, "Yeah, you know, you're my friend. I'll go and support you." And what I didn't note at that time is that that man was 12-stepping me. And I didn't realize what was happening. That man was taught in the few months that he was there, before he had worked all 12 steps, before he had had a year sober, that he can carry the message of hope to anybody who's still suffering. And I said, "Yeah, I'll go to a meeting with you." And we went to a meeting, and shortly after we started getting loaded, and you know, guys, I've heard a lot of, like, super big bottoms around here. And I don't have, like, a huge, like, bottom. You know, my house blew up and because I was cooking meth, and the FBI came in. And that's, no. You know, what happened was is I was drunk one night. And when I drink, you know, I got to do drugs because my life's unmanageable. And I think if I drink and do drugs, the drugs will mellow out the booze and I'll be able to manage. And I didn't have any money, and the drug dealer at the time was a really nice gal, and she was not physically attractive whatsoever. And I knocked on her door and I said, "Hey, I need something from you." And I said, "I don't have any money." And she says, "Well, if you want what I have, you're going to have to take care of me physically." And that was a tall order even for me at the time. And I said, "Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do, you know?" And that morning I came out of that house and I walked into Vern's house and I just fell on the ground and I said, I can't keep going on like this. That was my bottom. Yeah. Tough guy on the outside, total wimp on the inside. I get it, you know? I'm willing to go to any length. And and what happened is I had a friend who I had been talking to, Vern and I had been talking to in that short time that he was clean, and he was living in a sober living. And I knew I didn't need a program, but I knew I needed to live somewhere where they don't drink. So I called him and I said, hey, they don't drink at that sober living, right? And he says, yeah. I said, perfect, sign me up. And I moved down there, and the lady goes, you know, in order to live here, you have not drank or used drugs in the last 48 hours. Have you done that? And I said, absolutely, I have. And I had smoked some speed before I walked into her house. And I moved into that sober living, and I detoxed in there. And and I had 3 weeks sober at the time. I had 3 weeks sober in Narcotics Anonymous. And, you know, one thing I used to do a lot is because I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous is I used to put that program down a lot. And I used to say a lot of bad things about that program, how it's coming up short and that they just can't handle Alcoholics Anonymous. And I owe that program a huge amends for that. That program saved my life. And I'm very grateful for it. And what happened is I had 3 weeks sober, and I'm running around the job. You know, I'm framing houses. I'm running around the job, and I'm telling people I'm sober, I'm sober. And this little plumber guy who had seen me on jobs before, one of the only guys who talked to me, because my behavior is so erratic that nobody wants to talk to me on a job site. And the only reason why the bosses kept me around is because I was a damn good framer, you know. And I go, Steve, man, I'm sober for 3 weeks. Can you believe it? And he pulled me aside and he said, you know, Eric, I have 7 years clean in Narcotics Anonymous. And I had my first spiritual experience at that moment. I was like, no way. There's no way you have 7 years clean, dude. And he said, yeah. I go, I need a sponsor. And he goes, why don't you come down to my house for dinner tonight? He was pregnant with Devin, and he had a 3-year-old daughter, Taylor, and his wife, Laura. And so I went down there and had dinner with him. This man invited me into his house. That man invited Eric into his house. I wasn't getting invited anywhere, guys. And we started on this path, you know, and I stayed sober for 5.5 months on one meeting, sober softball and a sober living. You know, I did half of the first step. And I got loaded. And what happened was I walked out of that hotel room that morning and something happened. That pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization had hit me like it never hit me before. And I opened that door at 7 in the morning and the sun was hitting me in the face. And I had nowhere to go and nowhere to turn. And what I remembered is this little plumber reached his hand out to me and invited me over to his house for dinner. And I went to the softball fields that morning, and I walked up to him, and I'm crying, and I'm broke down like I get. And I said, Steve, I messed up. And what I thought I was going to hear from is, Eric, you're a loser. Eric, you need help. Eric, you're different. Eric, get away from me. And that's not what I heard that morning. What I heard was, Eric, I love you. I'd love to sponsor you. Let's do this. That man showed me a way of living that morning. That man gave me a gift that I can never, ever repay. No matter how many service commitments I take, no matter how many guys I take through the books, I will never be able to repay that debt. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous at 5 years sober. And I did not get here because I wanted what you guys had. I didn't want to be like the treasurer up here making his announcement, you know, please contribute. I didn't want to be like our H&I rep over here, you know, the gold can, you know, let's help some other people. I didn't want to be like the greeters at the door. I didn't want to be like the bikers in here or the surfers. No, I didn't want any of that crap. I followed a girl into Alcoholics Anonymous. She had what I wanted. And I was willing to go to any length to get it. And one of the meetings that I followed her into was Old Town Speakers on Sunday night. And that's my home group. And I was sitting there, and a man kept talking to me. And I thought he was talking to me because I thought that he thought I was so cool that he had to come and talk to me. And one day that man came up to me and he said something so profound, I'll never forget it. He said, "When are you going to get busy in here?" I wanted to slap him. He goes, "When are you going to stop stealing from this meeting? When are you going to start doing your job around here?" That man saved my life. That man taught me about Alcoholics Anonymous. He taught me to show up early to stay late. He taught me to put on a suit and a tie when I get behind the meeting of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, not because that's what we do in AA, but because that's what his sponsor taught him to do, so that's what he was going to teach me to do. He taught me to shake hands at that door. And I did not want to shake any hands when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to be left alone because I knew you guys didn't like me. I knew you guys hated me. There's no hope for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I know today is that that's a lie. There's all the hope I could ever want and more. If you're new, you're going to see a lot of examples around here. There is no one right way to do Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you guys find one example and stick with it. Find somebody who's doing something in here and do what they're doing. I'm going to end with this. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you will not want to miss.